So welcome to Public Health Out Loud, public health for the public. Hi, it's Dr. Jim McDonald, Medical Director of the Rhode Island Department of Health.
This is Dr. Philip Chan. Thank you everyone for joining us.
Yeah, it's a sunny day in Rhode Island today. So I know people listen to our podcast at different times, but I will just tell you, on a beautiful New England afternoon where the sun is shining and the shadows are just all over, it's just the type of New England beauty that just inspires me. So hopefully we're inspired for today's episode, How Safe Are Vaccines? Which is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, because I'm not just a public health physician, board certified in preventive medicine, but I'm also a board certified pediatrician. And I really think vaccines are some of the safest things I do, probably the most effective thing I do during a checkup. You know, you're an infectious disease doctor, Dr. Chan. I mean, tell me a little bit about how vaccines, they're kind of putting you out of business. Does it bother you a little bit?
No, I mean, it's a great thing. I think vaccines are one of those things that I actually think we take for granted. I think that vaccines have really revolutionized how we think about public health, certain aspects, infections, right? I mean, if you think about it, vaccines have eliminated some of these infections that that have really been worldwide scourges, like smallpox, right? So these are things that we've often forgotten about through the history of time because vaccines have essentially made them extinct.
It's funny you say that. You remind me of, like, I've been a pediatrician over 30 years and I've never seen a case of diphtheria. Yet if you go watch the movie Balto, B-A-L-T-O, or the newer Disney version, Togo, it talks about the Alaskan sled dogs going to Nome, Alaska and back for the Alaskan Iditarod was created over this for the diphtheria epidemic in Nome, Alaska. And they had to bring diphtheria antitoxin, which is not the vaccine we use today. But it really speaks to how vaccines in many ways have really eliminated diseases. Like over 30 years, I've still not seen diphtheria because we give that vaccine so often. And what a wonderful childhood infection not to see anymore. It's another one of those diseases that's really been vaccinated away, which I'm pretty excited about. And if someone needed a DVD recommendation for a day when it's not so nice, Balto was a great story. And so is Togo, by the way. But historical concerns do exist about vaccine safety. So why don't we chat a little bit about some of these major adverse events. Some things have happened, right? And the Cutter incident is something you know a little bit more about than I do. Tell me about the Cutter incident.
So yeah, I'd like to preface this by saying, of course, you know, this is something I tell all my patients, right? Is that everything we do in medicine has the potential to cause complications in some regard. I mean, even ibuprofen, Tylenol, right? I mean, you know, every day there's people admitted to hospitals because of the complications of NSAIDs, like ibuprofen can cause renal disease, stomach ulcers. And it's the same with vaccines. Although with vaccines, these things are, as we're going to talk about, are incredibly rare. But, you know, we live in the United States of America, right? No one is going to give you a medication or a vaccine if you really don't want it. And I think one thing I'm reminded of is, and it's certainly if we talk about COVID vaccines, is that is as long as people make a decision based on science, on evidence, in discussion with their primary care provider, I'm okay with it. I think the one thing that bothers me most as we get into this is people making decisions based on misinformation and myth, and basing their decisions about whether to get a vaccine on that. So I just wanted to put that out there, Dr. McDonald. Any thoughts on that before we start talking about some of this?
You know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things you get me thinking about is we live in such an emotionally charged time. You know, and I think if there's one thing I think about with 2020, I mean, now we're in 2021, but 2020 was such an emotionally charged year, not just because of the pandemic, not just because of the politics, but just because of so many reasons. And sometimes I worry that people make decisions based on how they feel. And, you know, one of the things that I think drew me to the sciences as a young man and still to this day is I love learning, but I also love being proven things. In other words, I love that the scientific process allows me to prove something. And it's part of why I'm drawn to the legal world as well. I like being able to prove things. And one of the reasons I just so enjoy science is you actually get to look at evidence. When you look at evidence, you examine it and you can make important decisions. Sometimes people don't always agree, but that's okay. That's part of why science keeps us going here. But I do think I worry sometimes that people make emotional decisions, which really may feel a certain way, but they're not in the best interest necessarily of where you're going. But tell us more. This Cutter incident, I was reading about it. You gave me some insight on it, but what happened with this Cutter incident?
Yeah, and I think when we start talking about vaccine misinformation as well, a lot of the misinformation and myths have strands of truth in it from prior experience. But I think it's important to really drill down when we start talking about these, like what has actually happened in the past and what may happen, certainly with future vaccines, and what is a real risk. So the Qatar incident, you know, this is in 1955. So one of the first vaccines out there, the polio vaccine. And it turned out the polio vaccine in 1955, some of the vaccine given to the public actually contained live polio virus. And so there were over 250 cases of polio attributed to these vaccines, which were produced by one company called the Qatar Laboratories. Hence, this is called the Qatar incident. It was really a defining moment in the history of vaccine manufacturing. And this has led to, I think, concern for subsequent vaccines, right? And we hear about this with COVID, that some people are worried about getting the COVID vaccine because it may cause COVID. And I think some of this, this is a strand of truth in that previous vaccines, this polio vaccine, actually contained live polio virus. And there is a realistic, if you will, concern from previous. However, I will say that the COVID vaccine really is just a fragment of the RNA that's given to someone in the vaccine and really has no propensity to cause live COVID. But that being said, it did happen in the past in a different strain of vaccine using a different methodology. So this is why some of these myths persist. But again, I want to encourage people that there's no way that the current COVID vaccines can cause actual COVID. And likewise, the other thing I'll just touch on briefly, Dr. McDonald, I'll hand it back to you, is this other disease syndrome known as Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS. So GBS is a rare disorder. It's where a body's immune system actually damages nerves in a person's body, usually causes muscle weakness, sometimes paralysis, which obviously is of concern. So it's a person's own immune system that actually starts to attack your nerves. And what's thought to happen is that, you know, and this happens, you know, not with vaccines, but just in nature itself after someone has an infection with virus or bacteria. And the thought is when someone gets specific viruses or bacteria, is that your immune system recognizes and kills these virus or bacteria. But sometimes there's a little bit of a similarity between the surfaces of the virus or bacteria, these antigens or epitopes. And so the immune system kills the virus or bacteria, and then it realizes that some of the nerves actually have something that looks similar. And so your immune system starts to actually eat away at one's own nerves, which obviously is an anomaly, a dysfunction, if you will, the immune system. And it's estimated in the U.S. about 3,000 to 6,000 people develop Guillain-Barré syndrome after getting various infections. And the infections can pretty much be anything that's out there. And so in the past, actually, there's two vaccines. There's a swine flu vaccine from 1976 that was recognized to have a very small increased risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome. And that was actually pulled from the market. I want to emphasize it was very small. And then there's another vaccine that there was a concern, the meningitis vaccine, meningococcal vaccine called Menactra, that in the early 2000s, 2005 through 8, there's a concern that Guillain-Barré may be caused by that vaccine. As a result of multiple studies, 2 million vaccinated people, that was not shown to be true. But you see some of these threads of previous concerns and side effects, some of which there is a small increased risk for previous vaccines, which have really permeated the stories and some of the media regarding COVID vaccines and other vaccines in general. And I know, Dr. McDonald, you had some experience as well in a story here about the rotavirus vaccine.
Yeah, you know, and I think the rotavirus vaccine of 1998 was an interesting story about how the surveillance system actually works pretty well. And I have to preface this by saying, you know, back in 1998, I was super excited the rotavirus vaccine was coming out. And I think a lot of people don't know what rotavirus is, but everybody who's listening to us has had rotavirus disease, I should say. And you might be thinking, how can I say with confidence everybody's had rotavirus, the disease? Well, it's the stomach flu. And you all had it before you're the age of 4 years old. It's just that common. And you know, when you think about rotavirus, it's often very common in the winter months. You get this vomiting and diarrhea often at the same time. And I can tell you as a pediatrician, it kept me busy. It was very common for me to go in the hospital, put little IVs in little babies. hydrate them from a day two or three or four, and then get them home. It was really the most common reason why I admitted anyone to the hospital for dehydration. And so when this vaccine came out in 1998, RotaShield, I was pretty excited about it because I wanted to prevent these kids from ending up in the hospital. Not just because I really didn't love getting up in the middle of the night going to the hospital, which I really didn't love that, but also it's hard to see your little friend sick like that. But shortly after the vaccine was licensed, infants developed a problem, something called intussusception. Now, intussusception is not a term in common everyday language, but that's really when the end of the small bowel, the small intestine, actually just telescopes into the large bowel. It can be painful for a baby and has to be fixed. It sometimes can be reduced with a radiographic procedure. Sometimes it has to have an operation, and sometimes it spontaneously fixes itself. But think about the Rota Shield, that vaccine was, they're starting to see reports that it occurred a little bit more commonly than in the pre-existing condition here. So it was quickly recommended that the use of the vaccine be suspended, and then it was studied, and several investigations occurred, and it was slightly more common. So it was actually removed from the market. That's what the advisory committee immunization practice withdrew its recommendation. What's kind of interesting is, I remember my son Noah got the RotaShield vaccine. And, you know, of course he did fine with it because it was a very rare unintended effect. It was very rare. But I remember one day, Noah was about, gosh, maybe 9 months old. He was sitting up in the bedroom one day. I didn't think much of it. I was getting ready to go to work and he just spit up once. And I didn't think anything of it. Of course, my wife Gail tended to him right away because she's a very attentive mom. And I went to work and think, a couple days later, Gail's sick with vomiting and diarrhea. And Gail is sick for 2 or 3 days. Friend came over to take care of Noah because I'm going back and forth to work. And it was just like, yeah, he had rotavirus. He spit up once, was happy about it, and didn't care. My wife, who had lost her natural immunity to it, was sick for 2 or 3 days with it. And it really showed the power of the vaccine. Now, for those people who were bummed out that the RotaShield got pulled off the market, RotaShield got replaced several years later with two different vaccines. One was called RotaTech. One was called RotaRix. So RotaTech and RotaRix. One of the other things about these rotavirus vaccines is they were oral, so they weren't shots. So that made people happy. So the RotaRix and the RotaTech are vaccines that are still around to this day, still some of my favorite vaccines that work great. And to this day, I really don't see many kids with stomach flu anymore because these vaccines work so well, which I think is kind of one of those really fun things about this. And you know, it's interesting, like in the United States, I think sometimes we take the power of our vaccines for granted, because in other countries, rotavirus is actually one of the more common causes of low young children's mortality. So young kids who pass away from a preventable disease in the United States or an easily treatable disease in the United States, to me is completely tragic. It's just an awful thing. I don't know, Dr. Chan, any other thoughts on the rotavirus vaccine or the rotavirus story?
No, I mean, I think a couple of themes just from what we both shared. You know, even when these vaccines have rare side effects, the point is that they're rare, incredibly rare. And I think you raised the case about the rotavirus and the Guillain-Barré. Even when these vaccines have been taken off the market, I mean, these longer term, you know, downstream side effects have been are actually really rare, even though they are significant. And you know, you look at the diseases that are now almost eradicated, right? I mean, you have polio, you touched on pertussis, you know, tetanus, et cetera. I mean, I think that in general, all of us, including ourselves, take it for granted on, you know, how severe and life-threatening these diseases are and were, and the amount of death and sickness they used to cause. So, you know, the public health impact of these vaccines in general have just been incredible, really game-changing for society in general.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, though, and I think this is something that probably isn't talked very much about, is there's really a robust surveillance system that is in our world regarding vaccines. And we'll talk about the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, the VAERS system, in just a minute. But the CDC with COVID came out with VSAFE, the letter V followed by the word safe. And the VSAFE system was new to the COVID vaccine. I was very intrigued by this. What a robust surveillance system. Dr. Chan, what are your thoughts on VSAFE?
No, I think it's great. I think both of these systems, the vSafe, with which you know, a lay person can enter. There's VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which providers can enter specific cases about adverse events. I think these are just great surveillance systems and exist so that we, public health, the CDC, can pick up signals in the population about what may be happening. So it's a, you know, certainly if people have side effects, reactions from any vaccine, they should enter something in either one of these. And obviously with the COVID vaccine, which we'll talk more about.
You know, the thing about the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which again, is not something people use in common day language. It's an old system, been around a long time. I use this as a pediatrician rarely because I usually don't have problems with vaccines. But I remember 3 years ago having a child who had an unexpected reaction after a vaccine. Wasn't anything serious, but I reported it so it can be investigated. But it kind of leads me more to, we've got robust surveillance systems, which I think are super, but there are myths about vaccines and there's COVID myth vaccines. And I think we should talk a little bit about COVID vaccine myths in particular, and are they dangerous? Are they concerned? And what are some of these myths? So Dr. Chan, one of the myths I've heard about is we can't trust the COVID-19 vaccine because it was rushed. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is a common question that comes up. I mean, the studies now for both the Moderna and Pfizer have been published. They're freely available, frankly, to anyone. And these vaccines have gone through the normal regulatory approval process, both through the FDA, the CDC, and we've even set up extra safeguards here in Rhode Island. I know other states have done this. I mean, we convened an entire vaccine subcommittee to relook at the data and make Rhode Island-specific recommendations. So I really do believe that no vaccine has undergone more scrutiny than the COVID-19 vaccine. You know, they were approved. They were developed and approved in a timely manner, but you know, the studies that have been done are the same degree of rigor and have been published in major journals, reviewed by biostatisticians and scientists. So they were conducted in a timely manner, but they've gone through the same processes. So definitely something we hear. The other one too, Dr. McDonald, that we often hear is that the vaccine, and we touched on this a little bit, but the vaccine will give me COVID-19. What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, it can't do that. It just isn't possible. And I think it just gets to how this vaccine works. And, you know, I think this is just going back to some of that molecular biology I had in college and in medical school. But when you're talking about injecting messenger RNA into people, I think that just comes out of left field for everybody. Like, what does that even mean? So it's basically an injection into your deltoid muscle in your upper arm, just like every other vaccine you get. But this messenger RNA is a little genetic message that tells your cells in your upper arm to do something. And the messenger RNA goes in the cytoplasm of the cells. Now, if you go back to your high school biology, you know, not in the nucleus, in the cytoplasm, a little stuff around the nucleus, and it tells it to make a protein. And by making a protein, the one it's going to make is the spike protein, the same one that the virus needs to enter our cells. And when you send that little blueprint in to make that spike protein, your body will make antibodies. And what's nice about the antibodies you make is it's like a hard drive. Your body remembers it. So a hard drive for a computer remembers everything. Hard drives crash, but our immune system sticks around for a long time. You don't have to have even plug it in and it works really well. So after you've had, you know, a dose and maybe the second dose in particular of this vaccine, you're going to have decent long-term immunity against COVID-19. So that's exciting, but you really can't get the disease from this. You will have an immune response. An immune response means you might get a fever, a sore arm, you might get tired, you might feel some other effects that look like your immune system's working. I don't view that as a problem so much as like, well, I'm glad I'm glad my immune system recognized it. That means the vaccine's working. So I'm pretty happy about that. But some of the other myths I'm hearing is that we don't know what's in these vaccines, Dr. Chan, as if this is some kind of mystery. Can you address that?
Yeah, so these vaccines are, you know, the ingredients are actually freely available online. You can Google it. They're in the package insert with the vaccines, again, available online. And in general, there are a bunch of some solution. But the two main components, as you mentioned, at least for the two currently approved ones, are mRNA, as well as lipids. And the lipids coat the RNA and actually allow cells to take it up. And that's it. I mean, they're pretty harmless ingredients in general, et cetera. So we know exactly what's in these vaccines, And there's nothing sort of unexpected. And I think one thing that you mentioned, Dr. McDonald, about the RNA sticking in the cytoplasm, one of the other myths that we commonly hear is about vaccines altering DNA. And just, the Moderna, the Pfizer mRNA, the RNA actually does not, it is physically just does not enter the nucleus where the DNA is kept. So that's another myth that we occasionally hear. And I'll ask you this one, Dr. McDonald. This is one that I've heard actually multiple times. In fact, I was at my grocery store shopping the other day, and my cashier recognized me, and we were chatting a little bit. And she said one of the reasons, and she was a younger lady, she said one of the reasons why she was hesitant to get the vaccine was because she was concerned it would make her sterile. How would you respond to that, Dr. McDonald?
Yeah, it's fascinating. When I first heard this, I thought it was an attempt at humor, and yet it keeps coming up. And it's interesting to me, like, this just reminds me, nothing spreads faster than a good old-fashioned lie. There's just no way this can possibly happen. In other words, there's no medical basis, there's no scientific basis, there's no way this vaccine could actually affect this. And I think this just gets to mistrust. In other words, I think that sometimes we just have to acknowledge that sometimes our emotions get in front of us, and people just don't trust. I've done a little bit of looking as to where this came from. It came from a discredited scientist in the United Kingdom. It's been widely debunked. But just because something's been widely debunked doesn't mean it doesn't get to the urban legend status. And I think one of the things I'm afraid of is that sometimes people make healthcare decisions not based on the advice of their own personal expert, their physician, or their personal other experts, the public health physicians around them, but from friends and neighbors who really aren't experts in the field. And so it's one of those things where I think we have to take a step back here. Obviously, this isn't possible, but yet this gets a little bit of traction here. So it's something that I think we need to be careful about. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, you've heard a lot of this myth as well. Any thoughts on this as well?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's scary. It's scary, especially for young people, young women. But I think, as you pointed out, there's no truth to it. There's no vaccine that will cause you sterile. And in fact, I would argue if there was a vaccine that would cause people to be sterile, like, it would be a form of birth control, right? For a large percentage of people, who want that. So there is absolutely no truth to that whatsoever. It reminds me sort of a little bit about the autism and the MMR vaccine, where there was one scientist who came out with that. It's been debunked for, decades since then, but it's really persisted in certain circles. So I just want to encourage listeners, certainly, that this is not true. There's not a thread of evidence to support this, et cetera.
And then what about this other thing that's coming up? Like, I hear this too. And this sometimes gets to, like, this is just a legitimate question, if you ask me. I've already had COVID-19, so I don't need a vaccine. Is this the same as natural immunity? And what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Chan? Is this something we even know the answer to right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there is some truth in this. So we do know that immunity can be achieved by one of two ways, right? Either having the infection in some infections or getting the vaccine. And so we know, obviously, for people that have COVID, is that a percentage of them, and I want to just emphasize this, not everyone, but a percentage of them will develop antibodies and natural immunity. Now, if you look at the evidence, it's not everyone. And it has to also do with how sick you may get, meaning, as people are probably well aware, you can have no symptoms in COVID. And it's definitely been shown that a lot of people who have asymptomatic infection may not develop immunity. So this is a little bit of a tough one. It's not yes or no, black and white. There's a whole spectrum on it. And so the current recommendations at this time are to actually get the vaccine. And this leads us, I think, Dr. McDonald, to a related question, which is, is natural immunity better than getting a vaccine? What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I don't know that we know the answer to that question just yet. I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. I think one of the things we'd have to say is when we look at other coronaviruses, generally, natural infection doesn't lead to long-term immunity. So with other coronaviruses, we just haven't seen that occur. So it makes me pause that maybe we won't see that from SARS-CoV-2, but we quite frankly don't know. I certainly think there's a good rule of thumb and never get sick on purpose. This is just a good life lesson is, it's just never a good idea to say, well, I'm just going to go hang out with people and try to get COVID because I'm young. That was a fallacious concept that was pushed forward by people in the Trump administration last year. It just quite frankly wasn't helpful at all. And it got people the wrong idea that we could somehow achieve herd immunity And I think we have to be careful about thoughts like this. One, when you don't know what you don't know, you can be dangerous, and you have to be careful, that kind of thing. So the Jim McDonald approach is, I'm just preventing myself from getting the disease, period. And, you know, when the vaccine becomes available, I plan on getting it. And it just makes me think that that's probably the wisest way to go. But there's another myth I've heard about. When this one, it just doesn't make a bit of sense to me. The flu vaccine will protect against COVID-19. Have you heard this one, Dr. Chan? Any thoughts on it?
Yeah, so we know that the vaccines are really specific to the infection that they're trying to protect against. So the flu vaccine will not protect against COVID-19. There is some evidence, and I'm a little bit hesitant to say this, but there is a little bit of evidence that when you do get a vaccine, is that it does stimulate your immune system, right? It kind of, you know, if you're thinking about an analogy, perhaps your army, you get your guard up. And there is some evidence that potentially getting a vaccine will stimulate your overall immune system, which may slightly protect you against other infections for that time. Now, that's not, as a rule of thumb, the flu vaccine is not generally going to protect you against COVID-19, but there is some thought, a little thread of evidence out there that receiving vaccines will, for a short period of time at least, rev up your immune system, if you will, and put you on guard for infections in general. But as a general rule of thumb, the flu vaccine will not protect you against COVID-19. The other myth too, Dr. McDonald, that I just wanted to throw back at you was there's also I'm getting a lot of questions now about people who get vaccinated. Like, do they even need to wear a mask or physically distance? Are they okay to, you know, attend parties, et cetera? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, we don't know yet. We really don't. And it's interesting. I think people are assuming like, wait a minute, I got the vaccine. Isn't that the holy grail? Shouldn't I be good to go here? But that research is done yet. And part of why I keep my mind open about that is, remember, a lot of people who get sick from COVID-19 do so because they were exposed to someone who did not have symptoms, someone who was asymptomatic. So in other words, since asymptomatic transmission is such a wide part of the spread of this disease, we need the science to catch up to our real world and say, gee, if I get a vaccine and I get exposed and I get infected and my immune system takes care of it, was I transmitting disease to anybody? So that science is going to take a little bit of while. So I think it's going to be a while before we can say, I don't need my mask or social distance. And I think we have to let that research have time to percolate a little bit and come out there. One of the last myths I want to talk about is one I've heard that just to me, this got the weird award. So the vaccine contains a microchip by the government or Bill Gates and is the mark of the beast or one of these things. Oh my goodness. Like, you know, there's a special kind of paranoia to get into this particular myth here. I don't know how you got this far here, but I've heard this enough that it made me really worried a little bit. And I think this gets back to sometimes people are just too easy to believe what they hear and not give it some credible thought. Dr. Chan, I know you've heard this myth. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think it unfortunately speaks to some of the what's propagating in the media, conspiracy theories, et cetera. This goes back to my original point. I think, you know, if people decide not to get the vaccine personally for one reason or the other, again, this is the United States of America, you certainly have that choice. But just encouraging people to really think critically, this vaccine does not contain a microchip, certainly not by the government or anyone. It's these conspiracy theories that really give me cause for concern. So again, just cautioning people to really take a critical look at the information they're getting, where they get it from. You know, please trust the medical community, scientific community, you know, CDC, Department of Health. We're all here to try to help people, et cetera. So just a reminder for that. I think the other thing, and I just wanted to go back to this, you raised it earlier, Dr. McDonald, you were talking about some programs that exist should someone actually have one of these rare side effects or adverse incidents. Tell us a little bit about what exists to help protect people or compensate people in case there is an issue.
Yeah, so in the early 1980s, because there was litigation about vaccines and problems back with vaccines, one of the problems the United States had was like, there was litigation against pharmaceutical companies about vaccines. And pharmaceutical companies were saying, look, we weren't making enough money in this to make it worthwhile. We're just gonna stop making vaccines. Well, that was a problem because then you stuck with the public health problem of the vaccine preventable disease here. So the federal government got together and was probably one of the best things I think the government ever did in public health was create something called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So it's a no-fault alternative to traditional legal system to resolve a vaccine injury petition. It's been around since the early 1980s. And it covers the traditional vaccines that you and I think of today when we go to our pediatrician to get vaccines. But there is another program for the COVID vaccine and for other vaccine diseases come out as a result of emergencies or things like this. So there's something called the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program. So the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program was created. So if there's a problem or a serious injury from a countermeasure, which is like the COVID vaccine, you then can get some type of compensation from that. Now, this covers not just the COVID-19 vaccine, but anything for Ebola, anything for Zika, anything for anthrax, all kinds of different diseases that are quite rare that may not be nearly as thought of here, but it just gets out to like, there is a compensation program out there. So if you Google Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, if you feel like if someone has a serious injury from the COVID vaccine, that's someplace you can go here. And it is mentioned in the documents you get when you get the vaccine. And so I think it's important to know that one, we have really good history of vaccine safety in the United States. Two, we have really robust surveillance systems to find our problems. And we have a great surveillance system called VSafe with the COVID vaccine right now. And then three, there is a place to go if you feel like you had a problem to get compensation. But it kind of gets me back to kind of this whole thing here. It's like, when you think about the COVID vaccine from Pfizer and Moderna, they both are messenger RNA vaccines. And I just want to just get back to this concept a little bit. They're both very similar. How would you say that they work? Tell me what you think if you'd explain to the person who said, look, I've never heard of these things. I'm not familiar with messenger RNA vaccines. How do they work?
Yeah, so I think to just put it relatively simply, you know, science is cool. These vaccines both contain a little piece of genetic material for the virus, just a little piece. So not the whole thing, not a live virus. And you basically, when you put that in a person, your own body takes these pieces of the virus genetic material and start and copies it and makes this spike protein. And the protein is what the virus uses to enter and infect your cells. And so your body develops some antibodies against that. And that's what makes the vaccine effective. So it goes back to our understanding of basic science. I think it's one of the coolest things in the world. There's more vaccines to come as well. And we'll be chatting about those in the future as they become available.
Yeah, a lot more technology to come out of this too. I think this whole messenger RNA technology has got a lot more to offer. I do think it's one of those examples of part of the future of medicine that's going to be quite exciting. You know, we're kind of getting to the end of our episode here. And, you know, when I think about this one question of why does a vaccine matter, you know, one of the things I think about personally is, you know, I don't want to get the disease. I want to, you know, do well in life. And so I want to preserve my health. But the other thing is, when I think about if there's an answer to restrictions locally and globally, it's because we'll have an effective vaccine. Because what we really need to do in order to really have a nice lifting of restrictions, we've got to reduce the risk of people dying from the disease. And then if at all possible, we need to eliminate the disease. And we really can't eliminate the disease. I don't see how we could eliminate the disease without a vaccine, because it just didn't go away, nor will it go away. I mean, Dr. Chan, what are your thoughts on why this vaccine matters?
I mean, I think to your point, exactly. I mean, this vaccine matters both on a personal level. Like, I do not want COVID. You know, you've heard about long COVID. We talked about it on this podcast. In a subset of people, it can cause some really significant long-term problems. You know, from a public health perspective, right, I'm getting this vaccine to protect my household, you know, my family, my parents who are definitely older and, you know, a high chance of dying should they actually get COVID-19. So I'm personally getting this for a number of reasons. Imploring people to consider.
So Dr. Chan, you know, we're ready to close our episode. What's the final word from you today?
Thank you, Dr. McDonald. In closing, I leave everyone with a moment of Zen to consider throughout the rest of their day. And here it is, a quote from the Buddha, "One who acts on truth is happy in this world and beyond." Thank you all and be well.
Thank you. I want to thank Jose Garcia, our executive producer. I want to thank Carol Stone, our technical director.